Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, RICO and Extraterritoriality Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 20th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided RJR Nabisco Inc. v. the European Community. The European Community and 26 of its member states sued RJR Nabisco in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York, alleging that RJR conducted a global money laundering enterprise in violation of several laws, including the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a federal statute. The alleged RICO enterprise involved the importation of illegal drugs into European countries by Colombian and Russian criminal organizations, with RJR helping to launder their drug money through a cigarette import purchase scheme. Applying a presumption against extraterritorial application of federal law, the district court dismissed the European Community's civil RICO claim. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit vacated that judgment and reinstated the RICO claim, however, concluding that various alleged predicates for RICO liability had been intended by Congress to apply extraterritorially, and that other offenses asserted sufficiently important domestic activity to come within RICO's coverage. RJR subsequently obtained a writ of certiorari from the U.S. Supreme Court on the following question: whether or to what extent RICO applies extraterritorially. By a vote of 4-3, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Second Circuit and remanded the case. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, which determined that the question of RICO's extraterritorial application really divides into two questions. One, do RICO's substantive prohibitions contained in Section 1962 apply to conduct that occurs in foreign countries? Two, does RICO's private right of action contained in Section 1964C apply to injuries that are suffered in foreign countries? On the first question, the court held that under the facts asserted in this case, RICO's prohibition did apply extraterritorially. On the second question, however, the court held that Section 1964C's private right of action did not overcome the presumption against extraterritoriality, and thus a private RICO plaintiff must allege and prove a domestic injury. Because in this case, an earlier stipulation had resulted in waiver and dismissal of respondents' domestic claims, the court explained, their remaining RICO damages claims rest entirely on injuries suffered abroad and must be dismissed. Justice Alito's majority opinion was joined in full by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy and Thomas, and as to Parts 1, 2, and 3 by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in part, dissenting in part, and dissenting from the judgment, in which Justices Breyer and Kagan joined. Justice Breyer filed an opinion concurring in part, and dissenting from the judgment. Justice Sotomayor took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. To discuss the case, we have Corey L. Andrews, who is Senior Litigation Counsel for the Washington Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Andrews.
This is a case that the business community in particular has been watching for a while. The court was asked to decide whether the federal racketeering statute, RICO, applies extraterritorially outside the United States, and if so, what does that mean? To what extent does it apply? It's kind of an unusual case in that it's been litigated for 15 years now, and it actually never got past the motion to dismiss. It's had evolving allegations along the way. Essentially, the latest allegations claim that a far-flung conspiracy of drug dealers laundered money, and one of the ways they laundered money was by purchasing cigarettes, and they did this in the EU markets. And so the EU nations allege that the cigarette manufacturers were complicit in this money laundering and that that injured their sovereign country's interests because it injured their competition as they also sell cigarettes. So it's a case that's never, no evidence has been seen, no discovery has been had. It's really in many ways a poster child for sort of the way civil RICO has been able to be used. And so other than RJR, every other cigarette manufacturer was named in the suit settled, and I think the settlement sum is approaching $2 billion, which is pretty good work if you can get it. So in a lot of ways, this is a simple case. I think it's just superficially complicated because RICO is superficially complicated. The RICO statute has a substantive criminal prohibition. That's Section 1962. And that makes it illegal to engage in a pattern of racketeering in connection with an enterprise. And so you have a pattern of racketeering and an enterprise. Those are the concepts under the statute's criminal provision. A pattern is any two or more criminal acts within a 10-year period that are related. An enterprise is either a corporation or really any association in fact, which is what was alleged here in some respects. In a separate provision, entirely separate provision, Section 1964, there is a private right of action that we know as civil RICO that allows a plaintiff to recover for injuries to their business or property that were caused by virtue of a violation of the substantive criminal prohibition. So with that in mind, the court has sort of, in both the Morrison Australia Bank case and in the Kiobel case, has talked a lot about a canon of statutory construction that we call the presumption against extraterritoriality. And so that canon says, absent clearly expressed congressional intent to the contrary, federal law will be construed to have only domestic application. Congress is understood to have domestic concerns in mind. So in bringing that canon to apply in RICO, the court reminded everyone that it's a two-step framework, that first you have to ask whether the presumption against extraterritoriality has been rebutted somewhere within the statute. And that's something that it didn't have to really do in Morrison or Kiobel, or didn't seem to be much of an issue because those statutes gave no indication that they had extraterritorial reach. And so if and only if you satisfy that step, then you go on to look at the focus of the statute. And so much of the briefing and some of a good bit of the oral argument was about the focus of the statute, whether racketeering prohibitions were focused at overseas conduct. The court doesn't even really get to step two because it says if you look at the statutes themselves, particularly Section 1962, that they see an indication there that there is extraterritorial application. They derive that from the RICO predicate statutes, the litany of federal crimes that serve as a predicate under RICO. And so if you look at some of those, it's clear that they definitely have extraterritorial reach. The court lists a few, such as the prohibition against assassinating a government official, for example, or the prohibition against hostage taking. One of the provisions can only be applied extraterritorially. It's prohibiting the murder or assassination of a U.S. citizen abroad. So those are the federal predicates. Those are statutes that are on the books. They're not technically a part of RICO, but they're incorporated into RICO. And so the court says we want to look at the context overall. We don't just want to look at the Section 1962 language. We want to look at it in context. And in context, these predicate acts tell us that, you know what, as long as the predicate crime has an extraterritorial reach, then we think Section 1962, the criminal prohibition, also has an extraterritorial reach. And so that was actually what the Second Circuit held. And so a lot of the opinion is agreeing with the Second Circuit on that point. And this turns out to be a 4-3 opinion. Justice Sotomayor was recused, and the entire court signs on to the first three sections of the opinion, which governs sort of the reach of this substantive prohibition. Where the court starts to part company is when it gets to the civil RICO provision under 1964, which is really what this case is all about. And so there the court looks at the civil RICO provision and it sees no indication whatsoever in looking at that provision that there was any intention on the part of Congress to allow for compensation for injuries that occurred abroad. The government in this case filed an amicus curiae brief essentially making the same exact argument positions that the court ended up adopting. The government said, we think there are serious problems with applying civil RICO abroad, including, you know, interfering with international comedy, but we think we should be able to secure the interests of the United States in enforcing federal law in a criminal setting when the predicate acts themselves apply extraterritorially. And so at the end of the day, that's what the court ended up doing. So Section 1964 requires a plaintiff to allege and prove a domestic injury to business or property and does not allow for recovery of foreign injuries. That's the big takeaway holding from this case. As a result, the court remanded the case and basically said it needed to be dismissed because there was no way. In fact, I think the plaintiffs in this case waived the existence of any domestic injury. So that should end this litigation. The dissent was Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. And essentially, they would have just affirmed the Second Circuit. They thought that the Second Circuit's reasoning made more sense. There is a kind of logical, you know, beauty to it because they say, well, for the same reasons that context matters with regard to the criminal prohibition, it should also matter with the civil prohibition, the civil remedy as well. So there was an argument by the plaintiffs that, you know, it's silly to take concerns of international comedy into concern because in this case, we have actual foreign sovereigns who are the plaintiffs. So don't hang your hat on that. And the court made clear, Justice Alito, in his majority opinion, made clear that when we interpret the statute, we have to interpret it for all instances and for all plaintiffs, not just, you know, we can't just have a one-off when a foreign sovereign is a plaintiff. Statute means what the statute means, and it means that no matter who the plaintiff is that happens to bring the suit. So this decision is going to put an end to, you know, the plaintiff's bar effort that we've seen since RICO was enacted in 1970 to use civil RICO as a means of compelling settlements for claims for conduct that occurs overseas. One of the concerns that people had raised in the wake of Kiobel, which severely cut back the use of the Alien Tort Statute, was that civil RICO would be seen as an opportunity or a surrogate to pivot to in place of the Alien Tort Statute. And in our brief, we cite some examples of where this is happening and even some law review articles where people are saying you should do this. And this will put an end to that as well, so that the numbers of statutes that are allowing for U.S. companies that do business abroad to be hailed into U.S. courts for conduct abroad has been, properly cabined once again in this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.